KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I think it is extremely disturbing that this administration is playing so fast and loose with the courts, which are one of the three branches of our constitutional government.
The Trump administration says it is not defying court orders. Many legal experts disagree.
For Monday, March 17th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. AI can help you write an essay, but it cannot fold your laundry.
Yet. This hour, how researchers are applying AI to robotics.
There's no examples online of robot commands being generated in response to robot inputs.
And in honor of St. Patrick's Day, Irish fiction that calls back an earlier novel.
Colm Tobin tells me he could never quite shake his protagonist from Brooklyn.
About 10 years after I wrote the original novel, that image came into my head. And I thought, I know who that is, and I know what I could do now.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Mahmoud Khalil is asking a judge to be released from custody. He's the Columbia University graduate student who the Trump administration is trying to strip of his green card and deport over his pro-Palestinian activism. As NPR's Adrian Falier reports, he's being held at a detention center in Louisiana.
Immigration agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil at his Manhattan apartment building on March 8th and flew him to Louisiana the next day. The government is resisting his lawyer's attempts to have him returned to New York. He wants to be released from custody while he fights deportation. Khalil's wife is pregnant with their first child and expects to give birth next month. The petition filed by his legal team also asks the federal court to temporarily block the Trump administration from arresting anyone else for deportation because of their pro-Palestinian activism or for protesting Israel and its military operation in Gaza. Adrian Florido, NPR News, New York.
President Trump says he'll speak to Russian President Vladimir Putin tomorrow in the push to end the war in Ukraine. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukrainians feel helpless as they watch the most important ally appear to cozy up to their worst enemy.
I meet 34-year-old Taras, who doesn't want to use his last name, strolling in a Kyiv park. He says President Trump has parroted Kremlin propaganda.
Now there is a fear that senior U.S. officials may be in the same line with Russian leaders.
Trump says his call with Putin could involve, quote, dividing up certain assets. Taras says Ukrainians fear a ceasefire could be forced on them, similar to when allies dismembered Czechoslovakia to appease Hitler.
Munich Agreement 1938, did it bring peace? No. World War II started.
He believes Ukraine's forced capitulation would also lead to more war. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
President Trump has tapped Michelle Bowman to serve as the top banking regulator at the Federal Reserve. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Bowman is a former community banker who served on the Fed's governing board for the past 7 years.
President Trump said in a social media post that he plans to nominate Bowman to be the next vice chair for supervision at the Fed. If confirmed, she'll fill the vacancy left when Michael Barr stepped down at the end of February. Barr, who was appointed by former President Biden, continues to serve on the Fed's Board of Governors, but gave up the bank supervision job to avoid what he said would be a distracting legal fight with the Trump administration. Bowman, who helped to run her family's bank and later served as state banking commissioner in Kansas, is expected to exercise a lighter regulatory touch than Barr. Banking industry groups were quick to praise her nomination. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are starting the new trading week on a bit of an upswing after last week's extreme losses that left many investors worried. The Dow gained 353 points. The Nasdaq rose 54 points. The S&P 500 was up 36 points. This is NPR. Jesse Colin Young, the voice behind the Summer of Love anthem, Get Together, has died. He was 83 years old. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has this remembrance.
Jesse Colin Young and his band, the Youngbloods, did not write Get Together, but their rendition of the song captured the hearts of a generation wishing for world peace.
Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
Get Together climbed all the way to number 5 on Billboard's Hot 100 chart. After several albums with the Youngbloods, Young found success as a solo artist. He wrote and recorded music for more than 5 decades, much of which celebrated his love of the natural world.
When the morning sun is gone, shine the darkness from my eyes.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Shopping mall favorite Forever 21 has announced it is throwing in the towel and filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The maker of lower-priced handbags and cut-rate youthful clothing says it will shutter its U.S. businesses as shopping malls continue to fade and competition from low-cost online retailers eats into sales. The company and its owners say they'll wind down the business in the U.S. while determining if Forever 21 can continue as a business with a partner or it will sell off all of its remaining assets. The ceasefire in the three-year-old Russian war in Ukraine hinges on Moscow accepting the U.S. proposal of a 30-day pause in fighting. That's as confidence-building measure for both sides continues to hammer out a longer-term peace plan. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned Putin could look for a delay. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Oopsie, too late. That post on X from the president of El Salvador got retweeted by Secretary of State Marco Rubio over the weekend with a laugh-crying emoji over a headline about a judge's ruling. The judge had ordered the Trump administration not to deport Venezuelans to El Salvador. The White House invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to speed up deportation of people the president claims belong to a gang. So, oopsie, too late, as in, we can't comply with your order, judge. And that whole episode came after a Brown University physician in the United States on an H-1B visa from Lebanon was sent back, even though a federal judge issued an order that she appear at an in-person hearing on Monday, today. In a court filing today, lawyers for the government said U.S. Customs and Border Patrol officers said they didn't learn of the judge's order until after the doctor was sent back. The administration insists it is not defying court orders. Many legal experts are dubious. Last month, I asked University of Virginia Law Professor Amanda Frost whether Trump's earlier battles with the judicial system had created a constitutional crisis, and she told me, not yet.
As of today, at this moment, the executive branch has not taken the position that it can violate court orders or that it does not need to comply with court orders. So as long as we remain in a system in which the executive follows or at least states that it has to follow what a court says, I have hope that the system will hold.
Well, in light of everything that just happened, is the system still holding? Amanda Frost is with us again. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
We just heard what your benchmark was last month after the events of this weekend. Where would you say we are?
I would say that we are dangerously close to crossing that line that we discussed about a month ago. The administration continues to say that it is not refusing to comply with court orders. But we have seen it behave in disingenuous ways in terms of ignoring what courts have told it to do. And so I'm extremely worried.
I want to dig into that behaving disingenuously, because not to make light of a serious situation, but I think about like two kids in the backseat of a car and one kid says, I am not putting my hand over the line that you told me not to cross. And if any reasonable observer would say, actually, you are, does it matter that the annoying brother is saying, no, I'm not?
Well, I think it does matter in this context, because I think there is a difference in kind if an administration says we no longer have to do what a court tells us to do. And this administration has yet to say that. Nonetheless, I think it is extremely disturbing that this administration is playing so fast and loose with the courts.
I keep thinking about that oopsie too late post on X, which suggests that perhaps deliberately the administration is operating in a way that is hard for courts to keep up with. And there are other examples. Last week, there was a hearing before a federal judge in Maryland about layoffs of government workers. And a government lawyer said he didn't know whether anyone in government could say how many probationary workers had been fired. In this Venezuelan case, Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act without providing the courts much time at all to stop these planes of migrants that were heading for El Salvador. How do behaviors, how do actions like that impact the judicial branch's ability to do its job?
Well, there's no question but that the courts are extremely busy at the moment, but courts are used to dealing with issues on emergency bases. And I would say the branch of government that is most suffering from the flood the zone approach is the executive branch itself. Its filings are sloppy, filled with inaccuracies. It doesn't have the information it needs to inform judges about what's happening. It is failing in its role before the courts. And we're seeing the result, which is they're losing most of these cases.
If I could summarize your view as the clock ticks ever closer to midnight, but we aren't quite there yet, do you have a sense of how widespread that view is? Like, do your colleagues say you're being naively optimistic or Pollyanna-ish, or are your views pretty mainstream at this point?
I would say I've heard a variety of perspectives. Some people think we are deep into constitutional crisis already. Others think we need to wait before we make such a declaration, and I guess I'm in that latter camp. And part of the reason for that is our nation has weathered storms before, and we have pulled through. I mean, one example, of course, is Bush versus Gore. That was an extraordinary legal decision deciding a razor-thin election in a way that many people didn't like, and the nation took a deep breath and followed the law. My fear is that that isn't occurring this time.
Amanda Frost is a professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School. Thank you for talking with us once again.
Thank you.
Artificial intelligence can find you a recipe or generate a picture, but it cannot hang that picture on a wall or cook you dinner, at least not yet. Some researchers are now trying to get AI to work in the real world by putting it into robots. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
In a laboratory at Stanford University, graduate student Moojin Kim is working on a new kind of robot powered by AI, similar to the AI used in chatbots.
It's one step in the direction of like ChatGPT for robotics, but still a lot of work to do.
Okay. All right. Well, you want to show me how it, show me what it can do?
For sure. So
the robot itself is pretty unremarkable, just a pair of mechanical arms with pincers. What makes it different is what's on the inside. A regular robot must be carefully programmed. An engineer has to write it detailed instructions for every task. But this robot is powered by a teachable AI neural network. Kim has trained it how to do a bunch of different tasks simply by showing it.
So basically, like whatever task you want to do, you just keep doing it over and over, maybe like 50 times or 100 times.
The robot's AI neural network learns, and then it does the task by itself. Kim brings out a tray of different kinds of trail mix, and I type in what I want it to do.
Okay, so scoop some green ones with the nuts into the bowl. See what happens.
This idea that you could just tell a robot to do something on the fly is the dream of Chelsea Finn. She leads the laboratory at Stanford.
So in the long term, we want to develop software that would allow the robots to operate intelligently in any situation.
By intelligently, she means the robot could understand a simple command like scoop some green ones into a bowl and execute in the real world.
Even just to do very basic things like being able to make a sandwich or being able to clean a kitchen or being able to restock grocery store shelves.
Simple, tedious jobs many humans would love to get a hand with from a machine. Finn is also co-founder of a startup called Physical Intelligence. It recently demonstrated a mobile robot that could take laundry out of a dryer and fold it. Again, the robot was taught by humans training its powerful AI program.
In that case, we actually had a workstation that was in the apartment that was computing the actions and then sending it over the network to the robot.
So we don't have to worry about the robots taking over outside of Wi-Fi range.
I think that, like, I don't think we have to worry about them taking over at all. We can just throw some water on them, and in most cases, they don't work anyway, so.
These AI robots still get confused, misunderstand, make mistakes, and just get stuck.
Robots are not going to suddenly become the science fiction dream overnight.
Ken Goldberg is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley who studies robotics. It's true that AI text writing has improved massively over the past couple of years, but that's because chatbots have a huge amount of data to learn from. They've basically taken the entire internet to train themselves how to write sentences and draw pictures. But, says Goldberg,
for robotics, there's nothing. We don't have anything to start with. Right. There's no examples online of robot commands being generated in response to robot inputs.
And if robots need as much data as their virtual chatbot friends, then having humans teach them one task at a time is going to take a while.
You know, at this current rate, we're going to take 100,000 years to get that much data.
One solution might be to let the AI learn inside a computer simulation. Researchers in Switzerland recently trained a drone how to race by putting its AI-powered brain into a simulator and running it through a preset course over and over again. When it got into the real world, it was able to regularly fly an indoor course faster and better than a skilled human opponent. But anything that wasn't simulated, wind, rain, sunshine, could make the drone crash. And flying around is fairly simple. Trying to interact with stuff like folding laundry, that gets really hard to simulate. So real-world training is too slow, simulation leaves out some important details, and some researchers think there are even deeper problems with trying to put AI into robots. One of them is Matthew Johnson Roberson at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
In my mind, the question is not, do we have enough data? It is more, what is the framing of the problem?
Getting back to AI chatbots for a minute, Johnson Roberson says for all their incredible skills, the task we're asking them to do is relatively simple. Look at what a human types and then try to predict the next words that user wants to see. Robots will have to do so much more than compose a sentence.
Next best word prediction works really well, and it's a very simple problem because you're just predicting the next word. And it is not clear right now I can take 20 hours of GoPro footage and then produce anything sensible with respect to how a robot moves around in the world.
In other words, the tasks we want our sci-fi robots to do are so complicated compared to sentence writing, no amount of data may be enough unless researchers can find better ways to teach the robots. Back at Chelsea Finn's lab, graduate student Mujin Kim and I watch as the robot tries to scoop the trail mix I asked for. On a video feed, it places an X on the right bin, to Kim's relief.
Usually that spot right there where it identifies the object and goes to it, that's the part where we hold our breath in.
Then very slowly and hesitantly, it reaches with its claw and picks up the scoop.
Mujin, did I just program a robot?
You did. Looks like it's working.
It's a very small scoop, but a scoop in the right direction. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. On this St. Patrick's Day, I want to revisit some of my favorite Irish fiction. Colm Tobin's latest novel opens with a heartbreaker of a dilemma. His main character, Eilish Lacey, opens her front door to a stranger who accuses Eilish's husband of having an affair with his wife, an affair that has resulted in a pregnancy. The stranger threatens to leave the baby once it's born on Eilish's doorstep. What would you do? The novel is titled Long Island, and it follows what Eilish decides to do and not do when this bombshell turns her life upside down. Colm Tobin, welcome.
Thank you.
So alert listeners will recognize the name of your protagonist, Eilish Lacey, because she was at the center of Brooklyn, your celebrated novel that published back in 2009. Were you always planning to return to her?
Never. I really never thought of it. I don't like sequels, and I didn't think I should do one. What happened was, about 10 years after I wrote the original novel, Brooklyn, that image, that initial image that you've just mentioned, came into my head, and I thought, I know who that is, and I know what I could do now. And then, just without thinking, really, I set about seeing if I could write the first sequence, the second sequence. And so the book began, but it wasn't deliberate, it wasn't strategic.
But she'd obviously been somewhere in the back of your mind. Yeah. And had grown up from a young woman in her 20s to now a middle-aged mother in her 40s, who has built a mostly happy life in America with her Italian-American husband, Tony. Why throw her such a curveball? And we're giving nothing away. This is on page, you know, the very first chapter of the book.
I wouldn't have written the book without it. In other words, I wanted a moment of a pure terror for her, of what was the worst thing that could happen at that moment. And just to see then if I could dramatize that. Obviously, if after a few pages it didn't work, I would have dropped it. She's so self-contained, so unselfconscious in so many ways. She's an outsider still in America, even after all the years, that her domestic life is the life that matters to her. Mm. And so this became for me a subject, I suppose, of drama. And it's a drama I'm interested in.
Yeah. And I have learned from reading several of your books, this is typical of some of your fiction, but so much of what happens between these characters goes unsaid. You leave us as readers to fill in, you know, what is really going through their minds. There's just so much restraint, to the point where I sometimes wanted to shake Eilish and say, just yell at him. just let him have it.
Yeah, she doesn't, she isn't like that. And I can get much more if she restrains herself, if she holds back, with the reader watching her, the reader wondering, how can she manage this now? So in her efforts to let him know that she knows, I have to find an image rather than having her simply shout at him, which really I won't get any drama from. That will be an obvious thing to do. I will have to find one other way. And so I keep coming up with ones and then I reject them, eventually find one that I think might work. But it's a constant sense of making sure that you're not writing a sort of, I suppose, a soap opera, or sometimes soap operas can be good, but I mean the obvious response would be, yeah, to let a big shout at him as soon as she sees him. But if she doesn't do that, then I think you can get much more from that.
Mm. So Eilish she grew up in Ireland. She's an immigrant to America. I don't think it gives too much away to share that as she wrestles with what to do about what her husband has done, she finds herself back in Ireland, in the small town where she grew up, in Enniscorthy. Did I say that right?
You did.
I did. You would know, because you also grew up in Enniscorthy.
I did.
She's wandering around. She discovers people and things that have changed beyond recognition, and plenty of things that haven't changed. And as I read, I found myself wondering if you were drawing on personal experience. You would know what it is to wander down memory lane in that specific town.
Yes, I think there was that 1976, the year the novelist said, is about the last year where I would have sort of lived in Enniscorthy and been, you know what bars people went to, the names of shops, the names of shop owners. So I was, using very much that year, but yes, also using that sense of returning, say, to my mother's house and spending a night there and being in my old bedroom. And yes, all of those experiences I think I know, particularly know from that particular town, those particular streets.
Hmm. And Eilish, as she is wandering that particular town, those particular streets, does she find herself a different person? Does she move through the world in a different way back in Ireland than she did in America?
She doesn't think about herself. She's not self-conscious in that way, but it's clear that she has developed a sort of style without knowing it, that she's extremely articulate, for example. You can see her intelligence working, but she misses the point of certain things that have happened at home. For example, she thinks her mother needs a new kitchen. And instead of asking her mother, in that funny, any of us who've had this know it, the funny days of jet lag coming in from America, where you get an idea and it's wrong and you follow it. And so she decides to buy all this white goods for her mother, who just is really insulted at the idea. Have I been waiting all these years for you to come back so that I could have a fridge?
It made me laugh because it's a very American thing to do, to think my problems will be solved if I can just get some new kitchen appliances. Yeah. Let's get a new dishwasher and it'll be fine. I mean, plenty of your Irish characters do find ways to reveal their views of America. I wonder if you would read a few lines from the scene where Eilish's former lover, Jim, is watching her.
If anyone were to meet them now, he thought, they might be a local couple taking a walk. But when he stole a glance at her, he saw that this could not be true. She did not look like a local woman. Her dress could not have been bought in Ireland. And the natural way her hair was cut, accentuated by the wetness, set her apart, as did the smoothness of her skin. But more than anything, it was the ease and confidence she had.
Speak to that last line you just read about the ease and confidence she had that was visible, apparently. I mean, there are plenty of people who have self-confidence in Ireland. Is that something that you were, I mean, I wonder why you wanted to put that out there.
She doesn't know what she looks like when she has come back after all these years. She doesn't know that how she's being watched. She's being watched for the quality of her dress, but she's also being watched for something else, for a sort of way of walking and moving that may not even exist, but Nancy, her old friend, sees it immediately when she comes to the door. Someone foreign has come to my house. And of course, Eilish is not aware at all that she's foreign in that way. So it's a funny mixture of illusion and something that's real.
Hmm. The ending leaves things not quite settled for Eilish and for other key characters. You've now revisited her in a sequel. Are you done?
I don't know. I mean, it's 15 years since the novel Brooklyn appeared, and I'm now 69. So I suppose maybe when I'm 84 and hobbling around, I'll come up with some new idea. But I wouldn't bet on it.
So trilogy, watch this space, TBD. Colm Tobin's new novel is titled Long Island. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
For many of us, the start of spring means the start of gardening season. And who better than Martha Stewart to guide us through the planting process?
The garden can evolve, and I love that about gardening.
The icon of domesticity joins us to discuss all the best tips in her new gardening handbook. That conversation tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, South African actor John Connie on telling the stories of everyday people who might not otherwise have a voice.
I see what they see. I feel what they feel. I have the same fears. I have the same hopes. I have the same nightmares.
That story after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge has ordered the Department of Justice to provide a sworn declaration by noon tomorrow to determine if the Trump administration knowingly violated a court order when it flew plane loads of alleged Venezuelan and Mexican gang members out of the country over the weekend and handed them over to authorities in El Salvador without due process. White House border czar Tom Homan says the judge's order to turn the flights around came at about the same time the planes were in the air.
It wasn't until this flight was already in international waters heading down to El Salvador that the judge made some comment about returning the flights. We're already in international waters. We're outside the borders of the United States. I'm the border czar. Once you're outside the border, you know, it is what it is.
President Trump invoked a 200-year-old law called the Alien Enemies Act to go ahead with the deportations, even though the judge temporarily halted the move to consider whether it's legal or not. Parents can help their teens by talking to them about what they're watching online. That's the latest recommendation from a report about screens and teens from the American Psychological Association. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
It's not so much time spent watching screens, but what they're watching that can be dangerous for teens. That's why talking to them is important. Mitch Prinstein is chief science officer with the APA.
Can really open up the door to conversations that these days I think happen so rarely because there's so many devices and opportunities for kids to do this independently now.
Parents don't need to have all the answers, says Prinstein. They just need to stay engaged. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished modestly higher ahead of this week's Federal Reserve meeting on interest rates. Inflation improved last month, but it's still high, and tariffs could push it higher. You're listening to NPR News. Los Angeles-based Forever 21 has declared bankruptcy for the second time. The fast fashion chain was once a formidable anchor for American malls nationwide, as NPR's Alina Selyuk reports. Since its first bankruptcy 5 years ago, it's been a shell of its former self.
Forever 21 grew massive in the early 2000s by making designer-style fashion accessible, bringing runway styles to mall shoppers for cheap prices. This was the dawn of fast fashion. The chain expanded aggressively and over time struggled to compete with even faster, even cheaper online rivals. Companies like ASOS and Boohoo, and now Shein and Temu shipping ultra-fast fashion from China. Forever 21 survived its first bankruptcy in 2019 as a smaller company with new owners. Now it's back on the auction block, losing money and shoppers, blaming online competition and high inflation, warning that this could be the end of the line. Forever liquidation. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
Well, higher tariffs on imported lumber and appliances this spring could drive up the cost of building materials and home improvement projects. Analysts say the Trump administration's tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China are projected to raise the costs for a single-family home by up to $10,000. Roughly 80% of U.S. lumber comes from Canada. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station
and from EBSCO, committed to providing perpetual access to print and digital books for libraries and the communities they serve. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at Lodestar.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. We're going to speak next about a phone call. President Trump is set to speak tomorrow with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, as the U.S. continues to pursue a ceasefire deal in Ukraine. Over the weekend, Trump sounded cautiously optimistic.
We want to see if we can bring that war to an end. Maybe we can, maybe we can't, but I think we have a very good chance.
Yet Putin has raised concerns about the ceasefire plan. His critics in Ukraine and in Europe say Putin is looking to drag out negotiations and continue the war. To preview the Russian view, we are joined by NPR Russia correspondent Charles Maines. Hey.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So this ceasefire proposal is expected to be front and center on this call tomorrow. Sketch out for us briefly what exactly the proposal is.
Yeah, it would place a 30-day ban on all attacks by both Moscow and Kyiv, the idea being here that if it works, renew it and keep doing so as a path to eventual peace. Now, Ukraine signed on to the ceasefire plan following negotiations with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia last week. In doing so, Kyiv appeared to smooth over differences stemming from that combative Oval Office meeting last month, of course, when President Trump and Vice President Vance berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky before the press. In the aftermath, Trump put a hold on all American military and intelligence support to Ukraine, a penalty he had then lifted as soon as Kyiv signed on to the U.S. proposal. But the idea is that the deal has been always contingent on Russia doing the same. You know, will Putin reciprocate or not?
Well, and will Putin reciprocate or not? What do we know about his view of this deal?
Well, in public comments, Putin has complimented Trump for his noble mission of peace. He's agreed to the ceasefire plan in principle. But Putin has also raised all sorts of issues that he say require further discussions, including who would monitor the ceasefire. Russia's ruled out anyone from NATO member countries. Putin has also made it quite clear he thinks Ukraine signed on to the deal in order to stall Russian battlefield progress and therefore regroup. The same concern, frankly, that Ukraine has always had about Russia.
Now, another piece of the backdrop here, Trump had his envoy, White House envoy Steve Witkoff, was in Moscow last week. He was discussing all this. Do we know where those meetings landed?
Well, Putin, yeah, he met with Steve Witkoff behind closed doors, where, according to a Kremlin spokesman, Putin passed on additional signals to the American leader.
Hang on, additional signals. What does that mean?
Well, we don't know, but Witkoff later added that the U.S. was bridging the gap between the two sides. We do know that Putin wants a long-term settlement that addresses what he calls the root of the conflict. For Putin, that's NATO's expansion to Russia's borders, including, of course, possibly to Ukraine. But earlier today, I spoke with a former Kremlin advisor, Sergei Markov, who said the Kremlin fundamentally saw Trump as in a rush to rid himself of the Ukraine issue entirely. And Markov borrowed a metaphor from Trump's real estate days.
For him, Ukrainian war, just not profitable hotel, for example, building, which should be sold as soon as possible.
Huh, a not profitable hotel, I think he just said there. Charles, speak to one criticism of Trump, that he gave big concessions to Russia before these negotiations even began. Is Vladimir Putin giving up anything?
Well, the truth is we don't know. You know, Trump obviously said Ukraine will not join NATO. That certainly sounds like a Russian demand. Mm-hmm. I was asking Markov, Putin's former advisor, what, if anything, Russia was willing to concede. And his answer gives some insight, I think. Markov said the mere fact that Russia isn't taking more territory, that is the Russian concession.
Charles Maines, thanks.
Thank you.
The State Department shut down most foreign aid in January and started canceling hundreds of contracts. Sub-Saharan Africa, which receives more than a quarter of that U.S. foreign assistance, has been especially affected by these cuts. Ari Daniel reports that communities across the continent are grappling with the fallout.
Ernestine Nedimbaye is a midwife in Chad, and with the cuts to USAID programs, her job is now on the line. Nedimbaye is based at the Gaga refugee camp in the east. She mostly tends to women fleeing the violence in neighboring Sudan. Nedimbaye says one woman in particular touched her heart. Her name was Fatme. She was pregnant, and her husband and son had been killed in Sudan. Shortly after she arrived at the camp, Nedimbaye says Fatme showed up at the health center and went into labor almost immediately.
When she was giving birth there, she had absolutely nothing.
Nedimbaye stayed with her, helping her have a successful delivery.
I spoke with her with words to try to console her. I personally helped her by bringing clothing for the baby, so I created a bond by helping her trust me.
Fatme is not alone in her vulnerability. The World Health Organization says that Chad has the second highest maternal mortality rate globally. Many women there don't have access to a safe and sterile place to deliver.
And when they give birth at home, there are more risks of infections and bleeding out, and more women die in childbirth. And so I help women give birth not at home,
by getting them to a health center or a mobile clinic. Nedimbaye is one of 148 midwives across Chad who are employed by a program that's run by the UN and funded partly by the US.
This is critical life-saving work that they do.
Yewande Odia runs the program in Chad. Last year, she says U.S. money provided prenatal care to 100,000 women in the country and safe deliveries to 26,000. Now, the State Department has canceled thousands of contracts worldwide, and that includes the program that Odia relies on to pay her midwives.
Losing the U.S. funding is huge. The lack of midwives to support these women means that women will die in childbirth. That's the immediate impact.
Beyond this project, HIV treatment programs have shuttered. Tuberculosis screenings have stopped. Food assistance for malnourished children discontinued. The State Department didn't reply to NPR's request for comment. At a recent health conference held in Rwanda, this new reality of a world with only a trickle of U.S. assistance was an urgent topic of discussion.
The overriding message is that we must never waste a crisis. And this is a crisis.
Dr. Githinji Gitahi runs AMREF Health Africa, a continent-wide African NGO and the organizer of the conference. He says Africans have been talking about the need for self-reliance for years, but now there's a sense of urgency.
So already there have been workshops in Zambia for this reorientation, the same we see in Kenya, the same we see in Uganda.
At these meetings, government officials are discussing how to handle the new gaps by altering projects, finding new funding, or jettisoning programs altogether. Some of this effort was already underway because a fundamental change to USAID has been anticipated for some time.
So it is catastrophic, unprecedented, but not unexpected. The challenge is if there was actually a plan for transition, then we would not say it's a bad thing. What is a bad thing is actually the sudden unplanned nature.
This is what's left so many in Africa and elsewhere in the world scrambling. Africa CDC has called the gutting of USAID a wake-up call, one that may well be an opportunity in the long term, but for right now, officials say is causing desperation and heartache. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Trump administration has suddenly cut much of its funding to enforce fair housing laws. Legal aid groups have sued. NPR's Jennifer Ludden explains this battle, one of many, over how far the administration can go to shrink government.
A few weeks ago, Brooke Kirkpatrick panicked about being forced to leave her family's apartment in Willoughby, Ohio. She's 22 and says she'd told the landlord that her three-year-old has autism.
They were fully aware of the situation before moving in, and then we started getting noise complaints.
Making noises is a common way some people with autism comfort themselves. But after repeated complaints from neighbors, the family got a 30-day notice to vacate just days after her husband lost his job.
I was actually looking for homeless shelters on Google because I really was afraid that we were going to get evicted and we would have nowhere to go.
That's when Kirkpatrick found a local nonprofit that helps people facing housing discrimination. It's one of dozens around the country that are the main enforcers of fair housing law. Within 24 hours, her problem was solved and the family could stay put. But now that nonprofit is at risk of shutting down after the Trump administration last month cut off the flow of money to it and 65 other such groups. They got a letter saying it was at the direction of Elon Musk's cost-cutting entity known as Doge.
I've been doing this job for 25 years. Never have I ever seen anything like this before. It was absolutely a punch in the gut.
Patricia Kidd heads the Fair Housing Resource Center in Painesville, Ohio. The grants from the Department of Housing and Urban Development make up 85% of her budget.
We laid off more than 3/4 of our staff, and we have probably about 6 months till we close.
Last week, four nonprofits sued the Trump administration, represented by the civil rights group Relman Colfax. One of its attorneys, Lila Miller, says HUD told the nonprofits that the funding, quote, no longer effectuates the program goals or agency priorities.
HUD provided no explanation as to how that could be possible, and the plaintiffs are just doing that bread and butter work that is consistent with the congressional mandate.
In a statement to NPR, a HUD spokesperson said the agency will continue to serve the American people, including those facing housing discrimination or eviction. In a video on social media, HUD Secretary Scott Turner has said the agency is taking inventory of all its programs.
We will cut and consolidate as necessary because that is a product of change. We will also save money, we'll save time, and we'll save resources for the American people.
But several heads of fair housing groups say their work does save money. Every time they help someone avoid homelessness, it can save local communities tens of thousands a year. Amy Nelson at the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana says this abrupt cut to funding has left her clients hanging.
We have individuals who are counting us to stay open, cases that are already in the enforcement or court process, where individuals are expecting us to be there with them, to help them.
Zoanne Olson runs the Intermountain Fair Housing Council in Boise, the only such group in Idaho. With rents out of reach for so many, she worries what will happen if she's forced to close.
We're just seeing an extraordinary amount of evictions, like so many that we're getting on a daily basis, that it's so disheartening to lose this money.
A hearing in the legal case is expected next week. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Glenna Osborne. In 2022, Glenna's father, Ronald, died. To prepare for his memorial service, the family went through his belongings. They came across a note that Ronald had written about his dear friend, Eddie. The two men were both firefighters. They had battled blazes together for many years. Here's Glenna reading that note.
For firefighter and special friend, Eddie, who saved my life. And then there was a Bible verse underneath it, John 15:13. Greater love has no one than to lay down one's life for one's friend. My father told us that Eddie had saved his life in the past, but we didn't know all of the story. And in reaching out to Eddie, we found out much more about the story. Eddie said that he and my father were probably 19. My father was 19 and he was 21 at the time, so they were very young. And the firefighters had been called to a house fire. And when they arrived, they saw a two-story home engulfed in flames. And Eddie and my father ended up on the roof fighting this fire. And my father went to take a step and he started to fall through the roof. And Eddie quickly reached in, grabbed the collar of his firefighter coat and somehow pulled him up to safety, away from what my father had once said would have been a sure death with a house engulfed in flames and the roof caving in. And I'm sure at my father's young age, it was just a terrifying event and one that really stuck with him for the rest of his life. I can't believe and I'm so thankful that Eddie did this for my father and for my family, because without him, none of us would be here. So we are just indebted to him for his courage and his quick thinking in the line of duty and the fact that he saved my father's life.
Glenna Osborne of Greensboro, North Carolina. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own story at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Danafarber.org/everywhere.
Depending on your age, you might know John Connie as the voice of Rafiki in two recent Lion King movies.
Everybody is somebody, even a nobody.
Or as King T'Chaka in Black Panther.
You're a good man with a good heart. And it's hard for a good man to be king.
Or you might know Connie from his work with Athol Fugard, the South African playwright who died earlier this week.
Spit at me. Like I was a dog.
John Connie is a legend in South Africa. And while he has taken roles in Hollywood movies, his theater work is known for exploring how the brutality of apartheid affected everyday people. NPR's Elizabeth Blair talked to John Connie while he's starring in his new play, Kunene and the King, at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.
John Connie shouldn't be alive. Tens of thousands of black South Africans were killed or imprisoned under apartheid, and it was during that time that Connie performed in plays that reflected the harsh reality of what was going on. In 1975, he and fellow actor Winston Nchona won Tony Awards for Sizwe Bouncy is Dead and The Island, plays developed with Athol Fugard, who died earlier this month. When Connie and Nchona were back in South Africa, they were imprisoned.
We spent 23 days in solitary confinement.
About 6 years later, Connie kissed a white woman in a play in Cape Town. Not long after, he was stabbed 11 times.
One of the Afrikaans guys says, "We can go now, he's dead," and just kicked me. And that's how my wife was the one who grabbed me, put me in the car, drove to the nearest hospital.
surveillance, threats, none of this kept Connie silent.
When you grow up in a war-torn or an oppressive regime society, and you are at the receiving end of that injustice, inborn in you, inside, is unbroken commitment to the liberation of your people and you.
Ryan Coogler, who directed Connie in Black Panther, compares him to Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier.
These guys who are exceptional craftsmen, but also the consummate ambassadors for the art and for the communities that they come from.
He's just such a force in South African theater.
Lisa Fugard is South African playwright Athol Fugard's daughter. She says John Connie and Winston Nchona often came to their house to work on plays with her dad, but the only way they could do that legally was for Fugard, a white man, to get them work permits.
So he actually had to create this permit, I think saying that John was working for him as a chauffeur, and that Winston was either working in the house or on the property. And that sort of allowed them to circumvent some of the laws of that time in South Africa.
John Connie says that creative partnership with Fugard began in the 1960s.
Even within my own family, I never had a friend for such a long time. And we've done so many things together. We've been in trouble together, but because of white South African laws, I would be detained, he would be given a stern warning. And then they took his passport or they would restrict his movement, but I was the one who would get the brutal strike from the law. So we developed this incredible relationship, which was built on trust.
Connie is still focused on his native South Africa, this time on the lingering effects of 40 years of oppression. He wrote and stars in Kunene and the King, about a black nurse taking care of a dying white actor. Connie says there are white South Africans who think they didn't do anything wrong during apartheid if they didn't physically harm anyone.
What we'll remember most is your silence. And that's what I'm trying to make him understand, that you were born with this white privilege, which you are taking as normal, but you still had the responsibility at age 18, when you became an adult, to ask questions.
At 81 years old, John Connie says he will continue asking questions and telling the stories of everyday people who might not have a voice.
I see what they see. I feel what they feel. I have the same fears. I have the same hopes. I have the same nightmares. Therefore, that makes me feel like I serve my community much closer to them in a most intimate way.
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today, so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in.
Tell me where you been last night, Caroline. Mommy, do you think that is right, Caroline? All the neighbors laughing at me, and they calling me Moonsami. Tell me where you sleep last night, Caroline.